Okay, so, you know, when we talk about money, really talk, the related issues are that money, like time and sex, are some of the most focused upon concepts in our culture. Back to 1913, Freud observed that money is as bigger of a taboo, even at that time, than sex. So he wrote, money matters are treated by civilized people in the same way as sexual matters, with the same inconsistency, prudishness, and hypocrisy.
Wow.
And that's long time ago, and he was right on. And when we look at the issue of perhaps this triad of money, sex, and time, if I ask you, Casey, or any of the listeners about your relationship to time, relationship to money, and relationship to sex, I probably can surmise all kind of things about who you are not, what may give you meaning, what may give you a sense of identity. So when we look about these three things, money, sex, and time, it does define often or express who we are and what identity and what we provide meaning to. More specifically around money, money in this culture is a huge issue, representing issues of power, control, love, status, self-worth, sex appeal, freedom,
yep,
fulfillment, and much, much more. And most people admit never having enough money and never have enough time, and primarily men complain they don't have enough sex. And I remember kind of the old saying that if you don't have enough of what you didn't need or didn't want in the first place, it's applied to money and well as to time and to sex. So it's really not about the amount. It's about kind of who we are and what our attitude towards money. Therapists are notoriously clueless and phobic around talking about money. We can talk about sex, we can talk about molestation, we can talk about infidelity, we can talk about suicidality, we can talk about death, we can talk about afterlife and anything else, but somehow we often would not address the issue of money. And that makes sense, because this is why we chose to go to graduate school in counseling or psychology rather than getting our master's in business administration. As a culture, we have a big ambivalence about money. Kind of, in some regards, we want more of it, but then we talk about this person is filthy rich, or we talk about money grabbing. Even the term charging money has a certain aggressive quality to it. So when it comes to money, as a culture has incredible emphasis on it and ambivalent about it, and as therapists, we are really not very equipped about it. And my personal story about it is that I came up with a highly socialist family. My mother was a psychologist, and my father was a union organizer, and the idea was kind of how to help. Every evening or dinner time, my sister and I were supposed to report about the good deed we did that day. And my mother worked as a psychologist, part of the university in Tel Aviv, but she never charged for a client that she saw individually in private practice at home. She gave it 100% pro bono, because she felt she was paid by the university and some by the Ministry of Education, and she charged nothing. So I remember that for me to start charging clients, it was almost betraying the legacy of my parents. And so I felt guilty, even when it was $5 in Berkeley or in Boston 30 years ago. And so many people ask me, how did you get to this place that you're not concerned about asking, you know, whether it's $200 an hour or whatever my fees are. And but it took a lot of work. It's a lot of kind of consciousness, understanding about my relationship to money. What was my guilt about charging? Where does it come from? What is my calling? How do I want to live? How I don't want to live? So we each of us have a story about our relationship to money, which is kind of goes along the culture at large. So for the therapists who are listening to that, it would be good to get into kind of your own personal mythic story and about personal mythology of my friend Sam Keen called Personal Mythology Around Finance, Around Money. What is your relationship to money? And it would be very, very good place to start, because I spent years in therapy and consultation to try to overcome the sense of guilt. And as many people commented, that I did a very good job overcoming this sense of guilt. And it's very true. And so people called me for consultation this morning. I did two consultations and did not hesitate to charge $350 for ethics consultation for an hour each. And I went a long way from the guilt feeling of charging even $5. So we need, when we talk about fees, we need to look at the whole issue that many of us believe that profit are inherently incompatible with care. That we came to our vocation, to our calling as therapists, but we don't own the sense that we're entitled to earn a lot of money. Primarily, I can imagine, to some kind of personal attitudes that brought us to the profession. And some of us even have been cited as that we kind of like prostitutes, that we are being paid to provide some kind of form of love. And that's kind of an interesting analogy that we can play with that even a little bit more. More specifically about how is that, Casey? You'll just be a little bit kind of more specific about ways that we can structure fees and therapies, and then we'd like to talk about structuring fees at that time of crisis, and then we can talk about perhaps how to operate outside managed care. How does that sound?
Perfect. And then I think somewhere in there I want to talk about some of the emotions that come up.
Okay, yeah. If I don't intend to that, please kind of feel free to interject it in. So let's start kind of how do we structure fees in therapy. There are many ways to do that, and we're very, very important that we are very flexible. Of course, the full fee is the simplest one that we establish in our office policies that our clients read and often sign before the first session even, and whatever our full fee are. And the full fee has to do with the locale where you are. I mean, in L.A., they'll charge similar to New York, and where I am in Sebastopol, probably the fee will be lower. So you need to kind of, it has to be a little bit locale-related. Then we talk about sliding scale, and this is a very tricky one that I haven't been so very successful with doing it, because when we start negotiating with clients what they can afford before we start doing therapy, we are in a place of conflict of interest, and they want to present the situation sometimes as they have less money. That sometimes don't tell us about upcoming inheritance or perhaps retirement bonus. So it's hard to know. I didn't do very well. It's a legitimate way of doing structuring the fee. So I have a full fee or a very low fee, as in $5 or no fee. I didn't know how to negotiate the middle with new clients, but many people succeed to do it very well. I remember I was traumatized as a young therapist. Somebody negotiated with me for 5 sessions. We came to a fee, and I found out that, you know, a week later he went to Hawaii or something because he came to some money, but it never came up for the conversation. So I stumbled over that a few times, and to that day I'm not negotiating it very well. Then the third arrangement is no fee, and definitely many of us, if not most of us, have some commitment to give some pro bono therapy. It's ethical, it's moral, it's a professional thing to do. People work with insurance company, the third payment, third party payment. I don't. I give my clients a hard copy bill if they want to put it on their wall, they want to start fire with that if they want, or they can send it to the insurance company, or it's fine with me. I don't deal with insurance companies and whoever does the utilization review. I mean, I have enough high school dropouts around me other places and to deal with insurance companies waste my time. So I just
But how do you really feel?
I don't do that. Life is much too precious. I do deal with third-party payment, not only children where the parents pay. I have right now at least three clients that the parents back east or in Midwest or in California, wherever the parents are, paying the bill. And they want to support the 20 or 30 or even 40 years old children, whatever the arrangement is. And they sometimes think that having health insurance and psychotherapy is one fantastic way to support young people, not always young. So I bill directly the parents. And they don't have any, unless the client signs a release, I don't talk about clinical issues, but I get a release from the client, authorization to bill the parents directly. They don't get a diagnosis, they just get date of service and the bill. And I found out that many parents, baby boomers who have the money and would like their 20 years old children to find their calling, to find directions in life, to deal with issues of drugs and etc., are more than happy to pay. Another arrangement of fees are bartering, and for some reason Kempf has a very strong statement around it. I have no idea why, but most other professional organizations looking on it a little bit more in a more healthy way. Bartering has been part of humankind much before even there was therapy, before gold or silver. People just traded a goat for a camel and for bread and for rice. Two types of bartering. I won't talk about it. I have three articles on bartering online. As Casey mentioned, I have online course for 6E on bartering. This type for bartering for goods. When you exchange such a rice, sculpture, vegetables, whatever it is, that you can establish a fair market value and bartering for services. Bartering for services are much more complicated than bartering for goods because they are involved in dual relationships because you become an employer of some sort. So before you get into very complex bartering arrangement, probably just give me a call and schedule a consultation. So I won't go much. While I don't start with people on a sliding scale, as they lose their jobs, lose their homes, lose their health insurance, get sick, or whatever other thing happens, I do change flexibly the rate of payment. That means I can start with somebody with 200 and go down to 30 or 40 or 150, whatever has happened to them, and sometimes I'll go up again. So I'll be very flexible with my regular clients or even short-term clients, but I don't start with them in the middle, but we end up often attending to life events that they have. Are you still there, Casey?
I am. Okay. I got lots of questions for you, so keep going.
Okay, so we talk about fluctuating a fee as we go along. And perhaps a tip on marketing, when people call us, they often ask us two questions. They ask us, what is our fees and are you on my managed care panel? And this is the two questions that I do not answer at the first part. I go right away to ask them, why did they call me? What's important for them, and I take it from there. So two questions I do not answer in the first few minutes. I answer it later on. What is my fee, and am I on the managed care panel? So how much to about managed care today, Casey, you'll decide later on.
Okay.
Some red flags about billing and debt. Watch out for misdiagnosed in billing. It's a fraud. It's unethical. And in this day and age when people are having a lot of debt or in any other time, watch out not to accumulate debt with clients. It's in some situations appropriate. In many situations, it isn't. And if you made the mistakes and allow some debt to accumulate, be ready just to forgive it all and to document why you did it.
Exactly.
You, with insurance company, watch out. You cannot just forgive the copay simply. You need to create a clinical rationale and ethical rationale and maybe even legal rationale. The worst things that I found out as a forensic expert that you're going to call a collection agency. It's a terrible mistake to call collection agencies because you have no control about what kind of systems are going to use to collect. Are they going to harass the clients? Are they going to leave nasty messages? Are they going to show up and pretend to have guns? You don't know what you are signing up with. Many people, once they get the call, the nasty call or not nasty call from the collection agency, decided that they didn't like the service they got in the first place and end up with a board complaint or even with a lawsuit. So, bite the bullet. My advice will be, if you're dumb enough, the way I've been in my life, mm-hmm. more than once, if you're dumb enough to collect a big bill, a big debt, just forgive it. And I'm embarrassed to say the untold amount of thousands of dollars, how hard it has been for me to learn this lesson. But I learn it, and it still happens every now and then, but I forgive it. I do not send collection agency. I do not send harassment letters myself. I don't see it coming, and I just say forget it. If I didn't collect in a timely manner, how do people pay me? Some people pay cash. Waitresses and waiters like to pay cash. They just leave it for you like a tip on the desk on the way out. Many people pay cash at time of service, at the end of the session. Many, many people like to pay at the end of the month. They don't need to write a check, but some people cannot manage the budget this way. And then I have a whole group of people that I charge their credit card. Very simple to do this day and age. With the PayPal 20 years ago, it was close to impossible for everybody to do credit card. If you have a high school dropout at home or a teenager, they can set you up on a PayPal account in probably 30 seconds. So you can charge a card. You may end up paying 3%, but that's okay. Again, watch out that you are not joining people in accumulating more debt through the credit card where they pay 15, 20, 25% interest. So make sure that you are not contributing to the problem of debt when you charge their cards.
Can I challenge you on that?
Of course. Please do.
Is that not infantilizing the client? They have a relationship with their credit card processor, and that is how, you know, they manage their finances. If we are a therapist, are we supposed to be their financial manager as well?
You know, it's up to the client. When you say they're probably 2,000 ways that people view money. And when I work with the CEO, he doesn't have a checkbook, he doesn't have cash, he just have only a credit card.
No, I was responding, okay, maybe I misunderstood.
Sorry.
You over. I thought you said, make sure that we're not contributing to the debt of our clients.
Absolutely. We need to make sure that if we have a client, that one of the presenting problem or what comes up in therapy is that they have already $50,000 in debt and they are paying 20% on that, and they come to us and pay with a credit card, we are just colluding them. It's like giving a heroin to a heroin addict. I mean, we need to act responsibly. And it's not infantilizing, it's seeing the clinical vulnerabilities and attending to that.
I agree with you if we indeed take it and use it as a clinical issue.
It's combined. The fee is a clinical issue. We cannot separate it.
Yes, you and I agree on that to the max, totally. But what I was saying is I didn't want to not bring it up with the client and then not charge them on a credit card because I'm in my own head deciding for them.
Yeah, we don't want to do that. Each client has their own way to relationship to money, but if they want to add it to a $50,000 or $100,000 they have in credit card, I will not do that, but I'll definitely make it a clinical issue. What other ways do we need to structure the fee? Do they need to be referred to somebody? But I will not give a drug to a drug addict.
Got it.
And so it's definitely a clinical, ethical, and management issue all combined. And each client will have a different clinical presentation that we need to tie to them. Some people don't want to talk about money. Some people need to talk about money. And of course, then comes the whole idea, can people afford us or not? And again, it's a marketing issue that you, Casey, know so much about it, and you have attended to that so well. And the answer for that, can people afford us or not, it depends what's important for them. Is important for them how to parent a child? Is important for them to keep the marriage together? A couple called me a couple of weeks ago, and they said at the end of the introduction on the phone, they said they cannot afford it. And we continued to talk, but they understood that if they get a divorce, they're not going to have a house, but they cannot afford me because they have a mortgage. But if they don't, if they're not going to fix the marriage, they cannot afford to have another house, even rental. They're going to lose a house. So suddenly, therapy become much more important than mortgage in some regard. So each client present a different picture, and how do they prioritize, and what is important. And in this consumer culture of us, it's a fascinating question. Sometimes I ask people to bring their budget in to see kind of how do they spend. I mean, does he spend it on cars? Does he spend it irresponsibly on clothing? And what is the dynamic? Do they overspend on their children? And help people to think about their lives in, as manifest through their spending. And then therapy suddenly becomes very simple to put the $200 a week when you put it in the context next to extra airplane, extra car, extra shirt, extra blouse, extra whatever shoes.
Love it.
And so we help people kind of to think. But therapists, as I said at the very beginning, can talk about molestation and death better than they'll talk about budget, because they themselves kind of a little bit running scared around the issue of money. But if you don't talk about it, you don't learn how to talk about it yourself. First, your own. Deal with your own, perhaps, fear, trepidation, intimidation around money, you won't be able to help others around these issues. And we need to deal with it, especially now around this financial crisis, which is really, the financial crisis is a crisis of consumerism that people do not prioritize. And the American idea that more is better and resources are unlimited. And on top of it, that we're entitled to this limited, unlimited resources. And so kind of how do we challenge this myth that are so profound with this culture? I climbed Kilimanjaro with my son 2.5 years ago. He's now 17. And on the way back, we went to the Serengeti, and we spent some time. At one point, we saw a Maasai woman selling bananas by the side of the road, and I stopped the jeep. I asked the driver to stop the jeep, and we stood there for about 20-25 minutes. It probably felt like 5 days to him. And she sat by the side of the road with 3 bananas, and she was hoping by the end of the week she can sell one for 5 cents.
Wow.
And I showed my son, I said, this is her attitude towards money. That she'll get 5-10 cents by the end of the week, and she's content. She doesn't feel gypped. She doesn't feel God doesn't like her. She doesn't feel that Wall Street betrayed her. This is how. So how subjective it is. And she doesn't feel that resources are unlimited. You bet she doesn't. And she doesn't feel that she's entitled. But she sits by the side of the road on this dirt road for a whole week with 3 bananas.
Wow.
And you remember it to that day. I heard him telling it to his friends, the story about this Maasai lady sending, selling 3 bananas by the side of the road. So, but Americans don't know about this Maasai lady, and they think they're entitled. And so we need to educate them. Perhaps, what is it financial responsibility is? The crisis is not Wall Street crisis, it's really crisis that you and I, Casey, created in our clients.
Yeah.
With the way we consume and the way we think about money. So it's kind of not that easy for us to think about it ourselves as well as to educate our clients. So this is kind of takes a lot of work. We talked about debt. We talked about collection agency. Collection agency, just remember, don't. Kind of
don't.
Make it. Watch out to loan to clients or to get loans from clients. Even me, kind of the one who changed the field around issues of dual relationship, advise you to be, even Dr. Zur advise you to be cautious about financial exchanges as loans from therapist or to therapist. Fee splitting is generally in our field, unlike in law, real estate, medicine, is considered unethical and therefore illegal. It's many other professions do not have this kickback kind of concern, but we imposed it on ourselves as we impose many other. Let's kind of take some questions, and then we'll come back to the issue a little bit of kind of how to deal with the current financial crisis in a more specific way. Casey, you probably have 15 to 20 questions.
Well, you and I could talk about this for days. And for those of you, again, please go to the PBC2009.com, your resource center, click on the store tab, and look at some of the CE programs offered by the Zur Institute, by Dr. Zur. And again, if you type in, if you decide to purchase and you type in Leadership 88 on the checkout form, you'll get 10% off. Again, I get all of my CEs here, and it's just an amazing stuff. And the fun part about it for me is that you do have a lot on money. I mean, you just said you have a six-hour course on bartering, right? Was that right?
Yeah, and I have a course on fees.
Exactly. And I'll tell you, when I read that course, everything in me was, like, you know, popping around, because you know how, you know, making money for therapists and how passionate I am about therapists being able to talk about fees in a way that serves them and in a way that doesn't frighten them. And when I took your course, it was just fascinating.
And what you have done so well, Casey, you help therapists get away from the idea, oh, there isn't enough money. You and I years ago talked about, you know, the online psychic made billion dollars already at the beginning of the century. To say the least, the pornographers and the herbal medicines and alternative medicine. But just think about online psychic making more money than we do in some regard. So kind of the myth, that the justification that there isn't enough money out there, you know, wherever the people sitting here, look out the window and see what people drive around and what kind of houses they live. With all the financial crisis and everything, and people have resources, they always had, but the pornographers know how to reach it. Actually, the dentists know how to reach it as well, to access this. But we don't. So between the psychics, the pornographers, and the dentist with cosmetic surgery now, cosmetic dentistry, and of course talking about the diet industry and with a multi-billion industry, the money is out there and people spending it. But we just never knew as therapists how to access it. And you have been fantastic in helping people just bust this mess that there isn't enough money out there, because the pornographers and the rest of them haven't heard about this myth.
I was saying on one of the other calls that one of my colleagues, Chili Campbell, who wrote the book The Wealthy Spirit, somebody came up to her one time and says, you know, don't ever run a workshop in December because you can't make money. And she looked at them, having been very successful running workshops in December, and said, I'm glad nobody ever told me that before.
Yeah.
Because it is a myth that people don't have money. And I like to think, and I'm curious what you say about this, but when people say, I can't afford therapy, what they're saying is, based on my priority system right now, I don't see the value of that related to the value, that perceived value that I'm getting from other things.
Exactly. And this is where, in the first call, one of the things that I do, I try to get the sense, what are their priority lists?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I don't answer the question, how much it costs, before I get a sense of what is the value, where do they spend the money. And I think that most therapists go to there isn't money out there because they just have no clue how to deal with money. And because we went to graduate school for the profession of healing and care, we are almost, in some regard, inherently are not in tune with the financial world. It's an effort to most of us to do that because we came to this calling as a caring professional. So it's an effort. It's like teaching Wall Street people empathy. It would be as hard for us to learn about finance. That's well, kind of stereotypical a little bit, but probably accurate.
Would you agree also that we therapists have this sense of I'm not working as a therapist. I am a human being who happens to, whose personality is a therapist, and therefore it feels a lot like I'm not doing anything, so why should I be paid for it? I hear that a lot.
I haven't heard that much. I think that people do identify themselves as healers, as therapists, as psychologists, as counselors, and they're identified as a calling and vocation and occupation, but just do not know how to translate it to money. So I know they have the feeling that kind of we bring our humanity into therapies, but I think that most people that I kind of encounter, they identify themselves professionally very clear. I am a therapist. I am a healer. I am, this is my vocation, my occupation.
We do have a couple of comments on the instant teleseminar coming in that saying, you know, you're just so right. And there was one that was really precious where this counselor actually from Australia was saying that he was just last night talking to a client about the sexual fantasies, the client's sexual fantasies and longings that had never been realized with his wife. And then when he went to pay, the counselor didn't have enough change because he was paying in cash. And he said, I noticed how uncomfortable I felt and the dilemma as to whether I should ask him to give me more in credit or for me to be in arrears to him. I mean, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it's and clients get a sense when we don't feel very comfortable.
Yeah.
In situations, and it creates a sense of unsafety for them. And this is why I think therapists, with your programs, my program, just need to get to challenge the same way that I had to challenge when I felt guilty for charging $5 an hour.
Yeah.
I felt I was betraying my mother.
Yeah.
And but I needed to work on it, and I admitted to myself something is skewed in my thinking about it. If this is my calling, and I'm going to make my calling my occupation, I need to be able to develop a new relationship to money.
Yes, exactly.
And, but without tackling it, again, with programs like Yours and Mine, there are not too many of them out there. Grodzki, too, of course, she's done fantastic work with that. And the coaches in general have done a good job with that. Is that we need to come to help therapists come to term with this business of therapy.
There's a question coming in, and I have bouncing to answer it, but I really want to hear your stuff first, and that is, when and how do you feel about raising fees?
I raise fees regularly on my long-term clients. I have some clients that I've been seeing now since 1988, or even earlier as a psych assistant. I'm kind of three or four generation into this few families that I see them on intermittently long-term. So when they come back, they usually come back into a new rate. I hope people know what intermittent long-term therapy is. So kind of when you see people throughout the life cycle, sometimes you see them at the beginning for a year, once or twice a week, or for a few months, and then later on you continue to see them every year, every other year, sometimes for one session, sometimes for a couple of months, whatever the concern is. I raise fees for people that I've seen for a while, every couple of years, every two, 3 years, and sometimes I don't. I feel it depends on the situation, on the relationship. And so it really varies from client to client, but I'm not afraid to raise it a couple of years later. I don't raise it by $50 a couple of years later, but I raise it by $5 or $10.
You know, it's interesting.
Small increments.
In one of the classes that I took from the Zurich Institute on money, there was an article there, I'm not sure if it's still there, I'm betting it is, on raising fees, and there was a study done a while back that said when you raise fees for existing clients, you can cause a therapeutic break that you don't even really know necessarily.
And it's so true because it's, as we said, it kind of depends what the clinical presentation of the client, and it's our, hopefully, our skill, our capacity to bring the clinical complexities of money. And I've been called a prostitute when I raised money because suddenly the issue of money became pertinent, and they didn't mind prepare the check every week. And when I raised it, it was an incredible sense of betrayal, a sense to see a prostitute rather than a therapist. And it was a rupture.
Yeah.
And but a lot of things can cause rupture. So we need to be clinically in tune, not to do it very abruptly. In this kind of situation, you better bring it up by the beginning, by the first of the year, a couple of months ahead of time with some people. Will be, I'm going to raise my fees. Do you have any thoughts? Do you have feelings about it? What does it mean? And so we need, it's definitely, fees are clinical issues as well. Now, some people wouldn't like to spend half a second about the raising the fee. They say, oh, I've been expecting you to raise it for the last 2 years. I'm not sure why you're so slow on that. I mean, you're behind time, people told me. And so you need to know who to bring it with and who not to. For example, in the first session, some people, I learned in a wine country, that people got offended for me telling them what my fee. I remember somebody probably 15 years ago, somebody barked at me, I didn't ask you what your fee are. I said, whoa. Okay, so I need to learn. Now, they do get the office policies ahead of time, so they get, before they come to the first session, they know what the fees are. But I learned that I don't bring it up in the first session if people don't ask or I don't find it's appropriate, because this guy thought it was just completely inappropriate for me to bring it up.
And I just need to, for certain disciplines in certain states, that is actually a law.
They will know ahead of time. They'll be notified. They'll be
but
informed
you won't say
consent.
It.
But I don't need. But there's no law say you have to verbally say it on the phone call.
No,
if they get it on my office policies,
which spells
the fee structure, that's good enough. That's informed consent. They sign
exactly.
it.
As long as they know it.
So they always get it before they come into the room, whether they get it via email as an attachment, they get it via fax, I mail it to them, or they come 10 minutes earlier to read it and to do the bio before I see them. So they always sign the office policies, which is part of my clinical form online that you mentioned earlier on, part of the product that I sell, and they come to the first session after they read it, if they bother to read it. But I don't need to do it on the phone.
Exactly.
Necessarily. Again, I'll be flexible. Some people I will, some people I won't. And hopefully I know the difference. If I don't, I'll pay the price probably.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because this is one of those things where we're different in that I don't raise my fees. If people come and go, then there's a good chance they will come in at a new rate. But if I have somebody long-term, I would say only 5 times in my career have I raised somebody that's there for a long term.
And I have people scolding me for not raising the fees. They talk very poorly of me.
Well, maybe that's something I should reconsider.
Absolutely. I think it all depends. As you know, Casey, the word never appears only around, you know, what do we say? Is it okay sometimes to be naked with a client, you know?
Yeah.
You cannot say even never to that, because
right.
if you bump into somebody in a small town gym, in a locker
right.
room, there can be, so you don't have sex with current clients, and you don't harm them deliberately.
Right.
And short of this too, there's no never. So I advise people, it's okay if you don't feel like in general to raise your fees, this is fine, but make sure that some people may interfere with therapy. Some business people who continue to raise their fee with their clients, whatever services they do, and you don't, it may interfere with therapy if you don't. So
yeah,
it has to be client-based rather than principle-based.
I love that. I love that. Because you're actually, you know, it's the mirror, you know, the base of the two people, you know, being able to look back and forth and say that it actually might interfere with therapy by not raising the price. Because we do need, would you agree that we do need to model taking care of ourselves with our clients? Don't we owe that to them?
Absolutely. We need to show them how we do it with integrity, with care, with sensitivity. This would be part of the modeling, that we show them healthy business behavior.
Yeah.
And healthy clients that will notice that we don't do that will think poorly of us, and for the right reason. If I see somebody for 10 years for existential therapy about the meaning of life or the meaning of death, whatever it is, and I didn't raise fee for 10 years, that would be, unless there's good clinical or financial reason for that, that would be inappropriate.
Well, once again, just talking with you, I'm learning more, and you've got my brain spinning, so I'm very excited. Thank you. We have another question here that I thought is fascinating. It says, thank you for your wisdom, Dr. Zor. How do you clinically interpret situations in which clients do pay on time? Do you address this as transference? In other words, how do you talk with a client about their not paying on time as a metaphor or symptom of something being out of balance for the client?
I will talk to the client according to who the client is. If the client has a pattern of gauging love by payment or not payment, it's a metaphor that I've used with a man right now. He depends how much he likes the woman, he'll go to a good restaurant, a bread restaurant, or expectation of sex, whatever it is. So we use this metaphor with me when he was kind of delinquent on payment. And then other people, it may have to do with some transferential issues, or other people, it may have to do because somebody lost their job. So again and again, I don't do one way with everybody. I mean, this is one of the biggest problems that we have, that the only tool that you have is a hammer. Everything else looks like a nail. Not all our clients are nails. So sometimes I'll go into transferential relationship and the meaning of not paying me as it relates to me, to the client and myself, and sometimes it has to do with the client relationship to the world, or sometimes it has to do with the client relationship to losing a job, or so it all depends. So, but I will attend to clients being delinquent or kind of slow on payment. I will not take it unnoticed. And I may reduce the fee or even move in this time of crisis. There were some clients I moved to no fee.
Yeah.
And it was just so interesting because I felt so appreciated about the no fee that they refer me other people who could afford me very fast. Other people in this time of crisis, I change to every other week.
Yeah.
When people face important financial crisis, as millions of people have been facing in the last couple of years, I attend to that in a very realistic term, in a non-rigid. Some people need to take a break. Some people need to see me once a month. Some people need to see me for less. Some people are too proud to see me for less, so they want to barter. Some people are too proud to see me for less, and they want to see me once a month for full fee. Each case is a difference, and I don't have one rule fits all, but it comes out of a dialogue with a client, that so many therapists are afraid, not equipped, whatever it is, cannot really sustain a good dialogue around financial issues and financial possibilities. And sometimes I tell people, we're going to change your fee structure because you cannot afford it, but it may take us 3 or 4 weeks to figure it out, but we are starting as of today. Whatever we come up will be retroactively agreed, and people appreciate it so much.
Right.
This openness and flexibility, but it's a client determined. I don't have one rule that I'll apply cross situations.
You know, that's interesting because I usually have a rule, and again, maybe I should address this, but people could go one session behind in paying me, but if it was to go, if for some reason there was another session, then in my mind, we use that as a clinical issue to talk about what was going on.
You like, know, but if I was your client, Casey,
yeah.
and you apply this widget to me while I was moving from house to house and needed to transfer my bank account.
Yeah, that would be the conversation. That's
this would
I'm
be
saying.
The conversation.
It,
so
it never goes without a conversation.
Exactly. So you'll see that, you know, I don't have the money right now, and just
right.
you give me 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But you know I'm good for that.
Exactly.
So it's you're being flexible. You don't apply. We don't apply these rules rigidly.
Love it. Love it. And then
a couple. The context of therapy, that's yeah. kind of what we take into account. And this is part of the standard of care. We're dealing with the fee issue. What we want to know from an ethics and legal part of you, that you have a dialogue, you document the dialogue, you give your clinical rationale. And again, watch out with accumulation of debt. Definitely just forget about collection agencies.
Agreed. To me, it's not only the legal and ethical stuff that go along with that, it's just the karma. You know, I blew it by building up debt. Let me just get rid of this, you know, wish this person well.
Yeah, yeah, I blew it. That's what I say,
exactly.
kind of, you know, I just need to bite the bullet.
Yeah, and every time I have done that, something good has come out of it.
Good. I like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it. When we take responsibility, good things come up.
Absolutely. Now, a lady in Lake Oswego asks, I've set my fees for clients at a lower rate than those in my locale. This is partly because I prefer not to deal with insurance, but mostly because of the economic difficulties for many people. Do I limit my client base if I raise my fees and charge more? Am I devaluing my services?
The answer is not yes and no. You may be limiting your client base by starting low. Americans put value on money. So if you charge very low, it's like it may be a fake jewelry in the jewelry store. It may be a bad refrigerator in the department store, whatever it is. It may be a poor quality sofa. So you watch out if you place it low. People may not value it necessarily. So it really depends. I don't take insurance, and I don't put it low by no means. I've just, as we talked before, I just help people reprioritize and see how important it is that your kids will not do drugs. Perhaps seeing me for $200 a week will save $40,000 a month in any of the adolescence program in Utah. Or Betty Ford, or whatever it is, of the world. So I help people lining it up. As I said before, perhaps if you don't take care of the marriage, you may end up not having a house, not having a marriage, not having a retirement. So lowering the fee in order to get out of insurance company, it's kind of it's not based necessarily in reality. It's a myth that there's not enough money out there. So go online and put porn into Google, and you'll see
yeah.
where the money goes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a myth that there isn't enough money. This wherever this lady lives, just look out the window and see what kind of cars people drive. In my sense, they don't just drive the bicycles where you are.
No, I see at Nordstrom's, there's the SUVs, you know, the $50,000 SUVs in the parking lot there.
This is where the priorities are.
Yeah.
So this is, we are in the business of helping people. But again, in time of crisis, we do want to be flexible, we do want to be sensitive, and it will pay off.
And I think, as you said, that's by person basis, not just, okay, there's economic climate, so I'm going to lower my fees.
Absolutely. It's client by client, but with a lot of sensitivity.
Yeah.
And as you say, whether it's karma or good referrals, it pays off.
Yes. Now,
people will come back.
There's a great question here from somebody in California that says, how much time did it take to change your money issues regarding the no fee to the fees you charge today?
Years.
Yeah, exactly.
It was
me
a
too.
Lot of work. It was because it has to do with, you know, with just with analytic kind of stuff, you know. It has
yeah.
to do with who am I and what the values that I grew up, the work was much more than money. It was really
yeah.
about kind of establishing my calling
yeah.
and differentiating from mom and dad, not so much with values, but more with the expression of my calling.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a fantastic piece of work. And in some regard, I still deal with that these days. Not so much around money, but sometimes it's hard for me to take success very well. And I think it's a residue of that, so I need to look at that. But it was a good piece of work about me just growing. And I've done it with, I don't know, 140 thousands by now with people who just, you know, like with you, Casey, I don't know if you, I'm not sure, if, I think you do it individually too, you know. You go online with me and you speak for half an hour for the next couple of months and half an hour a week or every other week, and you're going to do exercises and go to kind of free you from this old tapes that kind of restrain us and embrace what needs to be embraced and let go about the other stuff. So it was a good psychodynamic work that was much more than money.
Yeah, I was talking with on the kickoff yesterday with Lynn Grotzky, and she was my first business coach, and I couldn't charge more than $65 an hour. She got me up to $85. You know, I was terrified.
And okay, I think I'm going to get you to $135. Yeah, but wait a minute.
Well, it's funny because, you know, our coaching rates now are so exorbitant, you know, compared to back then. But it was terrifying. She was kicking. She was kind of giggling when she was thinking about, you know, where I was to where I am now. And that's why I wrote the Be a Wealthy Therapist book, was because so many of us have gone through that place where, you know, we worry about, it's a sense of self-worth, I think, for many of us. For me, that was what it was. For you, it was values with your family. For me, it was, you know, am I really worth that? And then when I got it, that it's, like you said, a matter of priorities and what's going on, it's not really about me.
Yeah.
Great. And then this is an interesting one. I thought you would love to hear this one, too. Where do you find fee-for-service surveys for the areas of the country? This gal's calling in from Hawaii. Like, where do we find out what other people are charging?
Just two, three calls around. I mean, I don't know, just call fellow therapists and find out what they're charging. I mean, you don't need to do a big survey, you know. It's it can be a conversation over tea with colleagues. And people will tell you what's a full fee, and as you and I know, 90% of them don't collect a full fee. Not even close to that. The average may be half of their full fee. So get a sense of the full fee. I don't know, pretend to be a client and call a few therapists around and see kind of what they charge. Sometimes some people posting it online. You don't need a big survey. Psychotherapy Finance every now and then come up with a survey, and so does Kempt. I'm not sure if Kempt has kind of, I think Kempt has, perhaps have income, not necessarily how much they charge. But just ask around. It doesn't need to be a big scientific survey, and you'll be able to adjust it over the years.
And I guess my question for this person would be, and I'm saying this respectfully, so please take it that way, is why does what other people charge matter to you?
I think it has to do with the fair market value of our thing. I think it's what the market bears. I think it's a legitimate question.
Yeah.
It's not how much I wanted to sell my house. Not how much I have. It only has to do with what the market bears. So I think it's a legitimate question. We need to deal with what the market bears, not how much this beautiful diamond is, but what is the market, fair market value of this diamond or this therapy or this car. So I think it's really fair to be in tune with the fair market value of our services. I think you are right that it has to do also with how much you value yourself, because you're going to get a range of what's a fair market value, and then you need to place yourself. So it's both of them are correct. You have to know what's a fair market value, and then to place yourself within this range.
Well, and I think I would disagree with that in a way. I think knowing what the rest is fine, but not necessarily putting it in the range. You know, I define the fee as what you want to be paid for giving up your free time for entering into the therapeutic relationship. And I believe that if you can help the client understand, if you really understand the client's pain and you can help them see the value of seeing you, that price, people aren't shopping therapists like cars as a rule or houses. I guess I just slightly disagree with you on that. but I think we agree on the idea of the fee needs to be about, I guess what I'm saying is don't set a fee just because you don't think other people can afford it.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with a lot of statements. Absolutely.
Yeah. I love it when we get going on this stuff.
Yeah. No, it's very juicy. And I believe that it is in some regard like cars and dentists. It's like we have a value that we give to people, whether they want to be closer to God. And perhaps the biggest thing around fees that we need to mention before we kind of signing off is that I don't use a DSM if I can help it. I mean, I use it very little. And because when people want to live better, to love better, to be closer to God, to die better, to deal with a parent's death better, there's no DSM diagnosis for that. And it's completely non-pathological. And I know you agree with that a lot, Casey, and of course Lynn does, that kind of you teach people, you take the positive psychology principle, how to live with more integrity and with more meaning and in a healthy way, not just to overcome phobias and anxieties, because some anxiety shouldn't be overcome. There are good fuels to meaningful life. So I don't use a DSM base as my guiding for my treatment plan, but it's more kind of a health model and a lot of positive psychology principles.
And so if people want to do some consultations, you're doing those as well?
Oh, yeah, as I said, already did two today. So they go to my website and find me. You go to zurinstitute.com and write me an email. And
excellent. And this is a...
Be shocked with my prices, but yeah. Then you remember that I spent a lot of years in therapy overcoming my...
And you're modeling it. You're modeling it for us. I just am amazed at what we've covered here today. And as always, this energizes me so much. And for me and for all of the people on the call, I'm not quite ready to sign off yet, but I just want to tell you how important you have been to me in my life, and I know to a lot of people on this call. So thank you for sharing your story and all the wisdom that you give us.
Oh, thank you, Casey. You've been such I feel kind of I passed the baton. You're such a confident woman, much more than I am in many ways here. So I think it's fantastic what you're doing. And it's just so important and so few people, if at all, doing it right now. So you're really... You are in charge here, Casey, with
this
conference and the books and the DVDs and all that you do.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So make sure you guys go to the store.
But also if they can go to the free article, what do you call it, doggy bag?
Yeah, the goodie bag.
Goodie bag, no doggy. Goodie bag. I put a guideline for fees in psychotherapy and counseling, therapy in time financial crisis. So I put 4 or 5 free articles that talks about several issues that we discussed today. So including my entire guidelines for fees in psychotherapy are there.
Yeah, there's 4 articles you got there for us in the goodie bag. So thank you for that. That was very kind of you. And we're just very excited about this. And you're going to be joining me, I hope, in April for our next Therapist Leadership Conference.
Oh, you're really thinking ahead. April, okay.
Yeah, no, we've got 2 a year now. April is the Thought Leaders Conference, which we're hoping you'll be a part of, and then always in October is the Practice Building Conference.
Okay, April, the Kempft is in April, as CPA is in April, so move away from both of them.
They moved their date, so we are close. We are close.
Ah, okay.
So, but we look forward to connecting with you again. And again, go to Dr. Zur's site and check out the free resources on your online center. And if you had one piece of wisdom to give people as we close off, what do you think that would be, Dr. Zur?
You know, be brave in a way that you explore in your own relationship to money. Don't hide behind there's not enough money around. Look at your own issues and carry yourself with dignity and in integrity that you deserve.
Oh, love that. Love that. Bless you. Thank you. And I hope the boxes get unpacked by themselves by gremlins in the middle of the night.
That'd be nice.
Okay, bless you.
I'll tell my wife.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Okay.
Bye-bye. And then everybody else, don't forget to join us in a half an hour for the Q&A and Hot Seat Coaching. If you want to be coached online by me, make sure you call in on the phone. Okay, take care, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.